questions. Let's begin with Austin McConnell.
Shahid, thank you very much for your study. It was evident you studied quite a bit about the subject. I enjoyed it very much. I want you to talk for a little bit about the Apocrypha and other writings that you find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. From what I understand, there was only 22% of the Dead Sea Scrolls were actually religious in nature. I studied with a gentleman on this subject a while ago, and he got hung up on this quite a bit. So talk a little bit, if you can, about the canonization process. There are a lot of writings that are not considered canon that are found within the Dead Sea Scrolls. Lots of those scrolls. In fact, there's more. I believe the book of Enoch, if I'm remembering correctly, which we don't consider canon. There are 30 copies or so of that, and far more of those than some canon writings. So talk about the canonization process.
I think your number 22% is wrong. I think what you mean is 22% are biblical writings. But the overwhelming majority, in fact, I think 80% of the scrolls found at Qumran are religious in nature. Some of them are commentaries. There's a great scroll that's a commentary on the whole book of Habakkuk, for example. Some of them are what we talked about, MMT. That's a religious document, but it's a discussing how to keep the law and so on and so forth. So overwhelmingly, most of the books are religious, but not all of them are biblical. Not all of them are copies of the Bible. So the question about the Hebrew canon is a good one, and certainly much more in-depth discussion could be had about it. But Josephus tells us that in his day, which was Jesus' day, the Hebrew canon consisted of 22 books. Now you say 22 books, we have 39. Isn't that a problem? Where those other books come from that we have that Josephus didn't have? Actually, it's the same books. See, Josephus had all 12 of the minor prophets in one book. Josephus, and that was common in that day. 1 and 2 Samuel was one book. 1 and 2 Kings was one book. 1 and 2 Chronicles was one book. Ezra and Nehemiah was one book. Jeremiah and Lamentations was one book. And I think Judges and Ruth was one book. And so when you parse that down, in fact, I could do the math now, but you know, no one wants to see me do arithmetic. That's how you get from 22 to 39. When you combine those books that we've separated out, you've got 22, that's how you get our 39 books of the Old Testament. So that's what Josephus said was considered canonical in the days of Jesus in the first century. I think the best way to establish the canon is to talk about the books that are quoted in the New Testament. Which books were quoted by Jesus and the apostles? And I don't have the exact number, but it's significant. Not obviously not every book in the Old Testament was quoted in the New Testament, but many of them were. So history and the New Testament tell us that there was a clear difference between books that were considered to be written by prophets, books that were considered to be written that were in the canon, and books that were important to the history of the Jews, but were not considered to be scripture. There's a reason that they had all those copies of Maccabees and all those copies of all the other literature, because it was important to their heritage. I mean, that was their history. That was the history of their people. But it seems that no one, no historian, and certainly no apostle nor Jesus considered any of those books to be scripture, which is why they never quoted them. They never sourced from them in any way. They never even made allusions to them as many of the books of the Old Testament. We could have a whole study one year, I think, on the development of the canon, but that would be my short answer for the Hebrew canon. I think Josephus gives us the best insight.
Glenn Osborne.
Just to tag on to that, did the Essenes, or however you pronounce it, what was their issue with Esther then?
A lot of debate about that. Esther's the only book in the Old Testament that doesn't have the name of God in it. So the one theory is that these people were so pious, they wouldn't consider a book to be religious, they wouldn't, or canonical, I should say, if it didn't have the name God in it. I think that theory is ridiculous. They had all kinds of material they thought was religious material that didn't have the name of God in it. like the MMT document and so on and so forth, that I think we can say, well, who knows? It disintegrated, the copies that they had. I mean, not everything that they had in their library have we been able to recover. Maybe Esther was in that initial pot that the shepherd threw the rock into and busted it up. Who knows? If anything, we guess is speculation. But the theory that I've heard that, oh, it didn't have the name of God in it, so they wouldn't have even had it anywhere in their library. They had all kinds of sectarian, but even if they considered it a sectarian book, they could have still had copies of it. And so I don't think any of that's, I don't think any of that's reliable. I think that there just wasn't one there.
Shahe and I had the opportunity to go and see the largest collection of Dead Sea Scrolls that has ever been on display a couple of years ago. It was there in Fort Worth, Texas. And he goes down in that part of the country for meeting-related things, and we went over there and saw those together, got to hear some lectures from some archaeologists and translators. And I continued attending those lectures. Of course, he had to go back to Missouri, but I lived just down the road, and so I continued driving over. And this question was discussed, what happened to Esther? And the fellow who commented said something similar to what Shah had about the broken pot. Apparently, those first scrolls that were discovered, the shepherds, they didn't know how to read. So they didn't know what these scrolls were, and they used some of them for firewood. Quite a bit of them, actually. And so it is possible that many of them were lost. Maybe they just picked up Esther pot and burned it before they could get it to that Armenian.
That's right, Honda.
To disseminate them for a biblical translation. Any other questions? Brandon Stevens.
While the mic gets over to Brandon, let me comment about what Clint said about going to that exhibit. If you ever have an opportunity to go to a Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit, it was just, I mean, it was just amazing. Two things really struck me when we went to that exhibit. Number one, how meticulous the writing on these scrolls is. First of all, I've never been able to write small letters. I mean, it's just, it's the detail, it is, they had to save space, you know, trying to write on a scroll. So the letters are just so small and meticulously written. I mean, you can see the care and passion for what they were doing in every stroke and every letter. And the other thing that struck me was that this Hebrew Bible that's represented the Dead Sea Scrolls is the Hebrew Bible that was around during the time of Jesus. Now, Jesus, most of the time, I think, quoted from the Septuagint. But this was the copy of the Hebrew Scriptures that if Jesus had any training in the Hebrew Bible, which I'm confident he did, this is the edition that he was looking at. This is the edition that he learned from and that he memorized and that he committed to his life. That was just, I would encourage everyone to go see an exhibit if you have the opportunity.
Great study, Shai. I appreciate your diligent study. A lot of work into it, actually. My interest was especially piqued by Galatians 2 and the light that it supposedly shines on Galatians 2 and verse 10 in reference to the works of the law. I've always, and I know that a lot of us have done this, I've always defined that word law that's used in Galatians 2 with Galatians 3. Where Paul refers to the book of Deuteronomy 27, verse 26, when he says, "For as many as are of the works of the law are under a curse, for it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who does not continue in all the things which are written in the book of the law to do them.'" And then he continues in Galatians 3 to use that word law, obviously in reference to the old covenant. So I was just curious. I wondered what Mr. Reese said, if his contention is that Paul uses the phrase "works of the law" differently in Galatians 2 than he does in Galatians 3. I just wondered if you could help me
Now, I believe he when he sees the word law, in according to his commentary in chapter 3, he thinks that's shorthand for works of the law, that that's the same usage in chapter 2 and chapter 3. And I think the position that he would assert, and that many do on this issue, is that the condemnation that Paul is giving to the Judaizers is not just that they insisted that people keep the old law, but that they keep their version of the old law, which included all the Pharisaic man-made traditions and rules. And so it was one thing, it was egregious enough, according to Colossians 2 and the book of Hebrews, to say, to be a Christian, you have to keep the law of Moses. To Paul, it seems it was even more egregious to say, not only that, but you have to keep all these Pharisee rules as well. And that might be primarily what he's dealing with in Galatians and Romans.
Okay. I guess Galatians 3 and verse 19 is what leads me to question that when it says that the purpose of the law it was added because of transgressions till the seed should come. So there it seems like, and even before there in verse 17, where it talks about the law that was 430 years later after the Abrahamic promise. So that seems to be a clear reference to the old covenant. And I just wonder, I mean, I like the idea of being able to use the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, to interpret Galatians 2, but I was just wondering if that could be rectified.
And you know, I don't know that I have a great answer for that. I mean, I think you bring up valid points about chapter 3. Maybe he changes gears in chapter 3 to talk about the law of Moses in general, not just the man-made rules of chapter 2. You know, that's something we can discuss. I don't know the answer to your question right now. I'd have to think about it some more and to read up more on it, but there's something there. I mean, there's the only two ancient usages of this phrase are Paul and the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I think that there's something to that. There's something that Paul is calling upon when he uses that type of language that these people would have understood. And but maybe chapter 3 is a transition to the law of Moses in general. Maybe that's a way to harmonize it. I don't know at this point. Thank you all for coming. I know I went a little long, and maybe some of this was a bit tedious, and we covered quite a bit of information together tonight. In this time that I spent going to see the Dead Sea Scrolls and in studying the subject, I tell you, I mean, my confidence in the accuracy of the Old Testament has just been bolstered to heights that I've never had before. And you hear so many people all the time say, there's so many, thousands, hundreds of thousands of mistakes in the Bible. And you think, well, what do I make of all that? Spend some time to study that accusation. Because when you do, and especially this is the case with the New Testament, we've got tens of thousands of manuscripts of the New Testament books. You'll find that these alleged discrepancies, these alleged mistakes, are mostly spelling differences and maybe word order of a sentence. And they in no way change the message of the Bible. And I think that's the greatest blessing that we've received from this magnificent discovery. Thank you for your time.